As soon as he recovered from the blow which had knocked him unconscious and thus wasted even more time, Elric sent for Dyvim Tvar. He was eager for news, but Dyvim Tvar could report nothing. Irkun had summoned Sorceress Aid to free him, Sorceress Aid to effect his escape. He must have had some magical means of leaving the island, for he could not have gone by ship, said Dyvim Tvar. You must send out expeditions. Send 1,000 detachments if you must. Send every man in Melnibone. Strive to wake the dragons that they might be used. Equip the golden battle barges. Cover the world with our men if you must, but find Simeril. All those things I have already done, said Dyvim Tvar. Save that I have not yet found Simeril. A month passed, and Imrerian warriors marched and rode through the young kingdom seeking news of their renegade countrymen. I worried more for myself than for Simeril, and I called that morality, thought the albino. I tested my sensibilities, not my conscience. A second month passed, and the Imrerian dragons sailed the skies to the south and east, west and north. But though they flew across mountains and seas and forests and plains and unwittingly brought terror to many a city, they found no sign of Irkun and his band. For finally, one can only judge oneself by one's actions, thought Elric. I have looked at what I have done, not at what I meant to do or thought I would like to do. And what I have done has, in the main, been foolish, destructive, and with little point. Irkun was right to despise me, and that was why I hated him so. A fourth month came, and Imrerian ships stopped in remote ports, and Imrerian sailors questioned other travelers and explorers for news of Irkun. But Irkun's sorcery had been strong, and none had seen him or remembered seeing him. I must now consider the implications of all these thoughts, said Elric to himself. Wearily, the swiftest of the soldiers began to return to Melnibone, bearing their useless news. And as faith disappeared and hope faded, Elric's determination increased. He made himself strong, both physically and mentally. He experimented with new drugs which would increase his energy rather than replenish the energy he did not share with other men. He read much in the library, though this time he read only certain grimoires, and he read those over and over again. These grimoires were written in the high speech of Melnibone, the ancient language of sorcery with which Elric's ancestors had been able to communicate with the supernatural beings they had summoned. And at last Elric was satisfied that he understood them fully, though what he read sometimes threatened to stop him in his present course of action. And when he was satisfied, for the dangers of misunderstanding the implications of the things described in the grimoires were catastrophic, he slept for 3 nights in a drugged slumber. And then Elric was ready. He ordered all slaves and servants from his quarters. He placed guards at the doors with instructions to admit no one, no matter how urgent their business. He cleared one great chamber of all furniture, so that it was completely empty, save for one grimoire, which he had placed in the very center of the room. Then he seated himself beside the book and began to think. When he had meditated for more than 5 hours, Elric took a brush and a jar of ink, and began to paint both walls and floor with complicated symbols, some of which were so intricate they seemed to disappear at an angle to the surface on which they'd been laid. At last this was done, and Elric spread-eagled himself in the very center of his huge rune, face down, one hand upon his grimoire, the other, with the Octorios upon it, stretched palm down. The moon was full. A shaft of its light fell directly on Elric's head, turning the hair to silver, and then the summoning began. Elric sent his mind into twisting tunnels of logic, across endless plains of ideas, through mountains of symbolism and endless universes of alternate truths. He sent his mind out further and further, and as it went, he sent with it the words which issued from his writhing lips, words that few of his contemporaries would understand, though their very sound would chill the blood of any listener. And his body heaved as he forced it to remain in its original position, and from time to time a groan would escape him. And through all this, a few words came again and again. One of these words was a name, Arioch. Arioch, the patron demon of Elric's ancestors, one of the most powerful of all the dukes of hell, who was called Knight of the Swords, Lord of the Seven Darks, Lord of the Higher Hell, and many more names beside. Arioch. It was on Arioch whom Yurkun had called, asking the Lord of Chaos to curse Elric. It was Arioch whom Yurkun had sought to summon to aid him in his attempt upon the Ruby Throne. It was Arioch who was known as the Keeper of the Two Black Swords, the swords of unearthly manufacture and infinite power, which had once been wielded by the emperors of Melnibone. Arioch, I summon thee. Runes, both rhythmic and fragmented, howled now from Elric's throat. His brain had reached the plane on which Arioch dwelt. Now it sought Arioch himself. Arioch, it is Elric of Melnibone who summons thee. Elric glimpsed an eye staring down at him. The eye floated, joined another. The two eyes regarded him. Arioch, my lord of chaos, aid me. The eyes blinked and vanished. O Arioch, come to me. Come to me, aid me, and I will serve you. A silhouette that was not a human form turned slowly until a black, faceless head looked down upon Elric. A halo of red light gleamed behind the head. Then that too vanished. Exhausted, Elric let the image fade. His mind raced back through plane upon plane. His lips no longer chanted the runes and the names. He lay exhausted upon the floor of his chamber, unable to move in silence. He was certain that he had failed. There was a small sound. Painfully, he raised his weary head. A fly had come into the chamber. It buzzed about erratically, seeming almost to follow the lines of the runes Elric had so recently painted. The fly settled first upon one rune, and then on another. It must have come in through the window, thought Elric. He was annoyed by the distraction, but still fascinated by it. The fly settled on Elric's forehead. It was a large black fly, and its buzz was loud, obscene. It rubbed its forelegs together, and it seemed to be taking a particular interest in Elric's face as it moved over it. Elric shuddered, but he did not have the strength to swat it. When it came into his field of vision, he watched it. When it was not visible, he felt its legs covering every inch of his face. Then it flew up and, still buzzing loudly, hovered a short distance from Elric's nose. And then Elric could see the fly's eyes and recognize something in them. They were the eyes, and yet not the eyes, he had seen on that other plane. It began to dawn on him that this fly was no ordinary creature. It had features that were in some way faintly human. The fly smiled at him. From his hoarse throat and through his parched lips, Elric was able to utter but one word. Arioch. And a beautiful youth stood where the fly had hovered. The beautiful youth spoke in a beautiful voice, soft and sympathetic and yet manly. He was clad in a robe that was like a liquid jewel, and yet which did not dazzle Elric, for in some way no light seemed to come from it. There was a slender sword at the youth's belt, and he wore no helm but a circlet of red fire. His eyes were wise, and his eyes were old, and when they were looked at closely, they could be seen to contain an ancient and confident evil. Elric. That was all the youth said, but it revived the albino so he could raise himself to his knees.
Elric.
And Elric could stand. He was filled with energy. The youth was taller now than Elric. He looked down at the Emperor of Melnibone and he smiled the smile that the fly had smiled.
You alone are fit to serve Arioch. It is long since I was invited to this plane, but now that I am here, I shall aid you, Elric. I shall become your patron. I shall protect you and give you strength, and the source of strength, though master I be, and slave you be.
How must I serve you, Duke Arioch? Elric asked, having made a monstrous effort of self-control, for he was filled with terror by the implication of Arioch's words.
You will serve me by serving yourself for the moment. Later a time will come when I shall call upon you to serve me in specific ways. But for the moment, I ask little of you, save that you swear to serve me.
Elric hesitated.
You must swear that, or I cannot help you in the matter of your cousin, Irkun, or his sister, Simul.
I swear to serve you, said Elric, and his body was flooded with ecstatic fire, and he trembled with joy, and he fell to his knees.
Then I can tell you that from time to time you can call on my aid, and I will come if your need is truly desperate. I will come in whichever form is appropriate, or no form at all, if that should prove appropriate. And now, you may ask me one question before I depart.
I need the answers to two questions.
Your first question I cannot answer. I will not answer. You must accept that you have now sworn to serve me. I will not tell you what the future holds, but you need not fear if you serve me well.
Then my second question is this. Where is Prince Irkun?
Prince Irkun is in the south, in a land of barbarians. By sorcery and by superior weapons and intelligence, he has effected the conquest of two mean nations, one of which is called Oim, and the other is called Yu. Even now he trains the men of Oim and the men of Yu to march upon Melnibone, for he knows that your forces are spread thinly across the earth, searching for him.
How has he hidden?
He has not, but he has gained possession of the Mirror of Memory, a magical device whose hiding place he discovered by his sorceries. Those who look into this mirror have their memories taken. The mirror contains a million memories, the memories of all who have looked into it. Thus, anyone who ventures into Oin or Yu, or travels by sea to the capital which serves both, is confronted by the mirror, and forgets that he has seen Prince Irkun and his Imrurians in those lands. It is the best way of remaining undiscovered.
It is. Therefore, it might be wise to consider destroying the mirror. But what would happen then, I wonder? Arioch raised his beautiful hand.
Although I have answered further questions, which are, one could argue, part of the same question, I will answer no more. It could be in your interest to destroy the mirror, but it might be better to consider other means of countering its effects, for it does, I remind you, contain many memories, some of which have been imprisoned for thousands of years. Now, I must go, and you must go, to the lands of Oin and Yu, which lie several months' journey from here to the south, and well beyond Lormir. They are best reached by the ship which sails over both land and sea. Farewell, Elric.
And a fly buzzed for a moment upon the wall before vanishing. Elric rushed from the room, shouting for his slaves. And how many dragons still sleep in the caverns? Elric paced the gallery overlooking the city. It was morning, but no sun came through the dull clouds which hung low upon the towers of the dreaming city. Ymir's life continued unchanged in the streets below, save for the absence of the majority of her soldiers, who had not yet returned home from their fruitless quests and would not be home for many months to come. Dyvum Tvar leaned on the parapet of the gallery and stared unseeingly into the streets. His face was tired, and his arms were folded on his chest as if he sought to contain what was left of his strength. Two, perhaps. It would take a great deal to wake them, and even then I doubt if they'd be useful to us. What is this ship which sails over land and sea, which Arioch spoke of? I've read of it before in the Silver Grimoire and in other tomes, a magic ship, used by a Melnibonean hero even before there was Melnibone and the Empire. But where it exists and if it exists, I do not know. Who would know? Dyvum Tvar straightened his back and turned it on the scene below. Arioch? Elric shrugged. But he would not tell me. What of your friends the Water Elementals? Have they not promised you aid? And would they not be knowledgeable in the matter of ships? Elric frowned, deepening the lines which now marked his face. Aye, Strasha might know, but I am loath to call on his aid again. The Water Elementals are not the powerful creatures that the Lords of Chaos are. Their strength is limited, and moreover, they are inclined to be capricious in the manner of the elements. What is more, Dyvum Tvar, I hesitate to use sorcery, save where absolutely imperative. You are a sorcerer, Elric. You have but lately proved your greatness in that respect, involving the most powerful of all sorceries, the summoning of a Chaos Lord, and you still hold back? I would suggest, my Lord King, that you consider such logic, and that you judge it unsound. You decided to use sorcery in your pursuit of Prince Irkun. The die is already cast. It would be wise to use sorcery now. You cannot conceive of the mental and physical effort involved. I can conceive of it, my lord. I am your friend. I do not wish to see you pained. And yet, there is also the difficulty, Dyvum Tvar, of my physical weakness. How long can I continue in the use of these overstrong potions that now sustain me? They supply me with energy, aye. But they do so by using up my few resources. I might die before I find Cimmeril. I stand rebuked. But Elric came forward and put his white hand on Dyvum Tvar's butter-colored cloak. But what have I to lose, eh? No, you are right. I am a coward to hesitate when Cimmeril's life is at stake. I repeat my stupidities, the stupidities which first brought this pass upon us all. I'll do it. Will you come with me to the ocean? Aye. Dyvum Tvar began to feel the burden of Elric's conscience settling upon him also. It was a peculiar feeling to come to a Melnibonean, and Dyvum Tvar knew very well that he liked it not at all. Elric had last ridden these paths when he and Cimmeril were happy. It seemed a long age ago. He had been a fool to trust that happiness. He turned his white stallion's head toward the cliffs and the sea beyond them. A light rain fell. Winter was descending swiftly on Melnibone. They left their horses on the cliffs lest they be disturbed by Elric's sorcery working, and clambered down to the shore. The rain fell into the sea. A mist hung over the water little more than 5 ship lengths from the beach. It was deathly still, and with the tall, dark cliffs behind them and the wall of mist before them, it seemed to Dyvum Tvar that they'd entered a silent netherworld where might easily be encountered the melancholy souls of those who, in legend, had committed suicide by a process of slow self-mutilation. The sound of the two men's boots on shingle was loud, and yet was at once muffled by the mist, which seemed to suck at noise and swallow it greedily, as if it sustained its life on sound. "Now," Elric murmured. He seemed not to notice the brooding and depressive surroundings. "Now I must recall the rune which came so easily, unsummoned to my brain not many months since." He left Divam Tavar's side and went down to the place where the chill water lapped the land. And there, carefully, he seated himself cross-legged. His eyes stared unseeingly into the mist. To Divam Tavar, the tall albino appeared to shrink as he sat down. He seemed to become like a vulnerable child, and Divam Tavar's heart went out to Elric, as it might go out to a brave, nervous boy. And Divam Tavar had it in mind to suggest that the sorcery be done with, and they seek the lands of Oin and you by ordinary means. But Elric was already lifting his head as a dog lifts its head to the moon, and strange, thrilling words began to tumble from his lips, and it became plain that even if Divam Tavar did speak now, Elric would not hear him. Divam Tavar was no stranger to the high speech. As a Melnibonean noble, he had been taught it as a matter of course, but the words seemed nonetheless strange to him, for Elric used peculiar inflections and emphases, giving the words a special and secret weight, and chanting them in a voice which ranged from a bass groan to a falsetto shriek. It was not pleasant to listen to such noises coming from a mortal throat, and now Divam Tavar had some clear understanding of why Elric was reluctant to use sorcery. The Lord of the Dragon Caves, Melnibonean though he was, found himself inclined to step backward a pace or two, even to retire to the cliff tops and watch over Elric from there, and he had to force himself to hold his ground as the summoning continued. For a good space of time, the rune chanting went on. The rain beat harder upon the pebbles of the shore and made them glisten. It dashed most ferociously into the still, dark sea, lashed about the fragile head of the chanting, pale-haired figure, and caused Divam Tavar to shiver and draw his cloak more closely about his shoulders.
"Strasha, Strasha, Strasha,"
the words mingled with the sound of the rain. They were now barely words at all, but sounds which the wind might make, or a language which the sea might speak.
"Strasha."
Again, Divam Tavar had the impulse to move, but this time he desired to go to Elric and tell him to stop, to consider some other means of reaching the lands of Oin and you.
"Strasha."
There was a cryptic agony in the shout.
"Strasha."
Elric's name formed on Divam Tavar's lips, but he found that he could not speak it.
"Strasha."
The cross-legged figure swayed. The word became the calling of the wind through the caverns of time.
"Strasha."
It was plain to Divam Tavar that the rune was, for some reason, not working, and that Elric was using up all his strength to no effect. And yet there was nothing the Lord of the Dragon Caves could do. His tongue was frozen. His feet seemed frozen. His feet seemed frozen to the ground. He looked at the mist. Had it crept closer to the shore? Had it taken on a strange, almost luminous green tinge? He peered closely. There was a massive disturbance of the water. The sea rushed up the beach. The shingle crackled. The mist retreated. Vague lights flickered in the air, and Divam Tavar thought he saw the shining silhouette of a gigantic figure emerging from the sea, and he realized that Elric's chant had ceased. "King Strasha," Elric was saying in something approaching his normal tone. You have come. I thank you. The silhouette spoke, and the voice reminded Divim Tavar of slow, heavy waves rolling beneath a friendly sun.
We elementals are concerned, Elric, for there are rumors that you have invited Chaos Lords back to your plane, and the elementals have never loved the Lords of Chaos. Yet I know that if you have done this, it is because you are fated to do it, and therefore we hold no enmity against you.
The decision was forced upon me, King Strasha. There was no other decision I could make. If you are reluctant to aid me, I shall understand that, and call on you no more.
I will help you, though helping you is harder now. Not for what happens in the immediate future, but what is hinted will happen in years to come. Now, you must tell me quickly how we of the water can be of service to you.
Do you know aught of the ship which sails over land and sea? I need to find that ship if I am to fulfill my vow to find my love, Cymeral.
I know much of that ship, for it is mine. Grom also lays claim to it, but it is mine. Fairly, it is mine.
Grom of the earth?
Grom of the land below the roots, Grom of the ground and all that lives under it. My brother, Grom. Long since, even as we elementals count time, Grom and I built that ship so that we could travail between the realms of earth and water whenever we chose. But we quarreled, may we be cursed for such foolishness, and we fought. There were earthquakes, tidal waves, volcanic eruptions, typhoons and battles in which all the elementals joined, with the result that new continents were flung up and old ones drowned. It was not the first time we fought each other, but it was the last. And finally, lest we destroy each other completely, we made a peace. I gave Grom part of my domain, and he gave me the ship which sails over land and sea. But he gave it somewhat unwillingly, and thus it sails the sea better than it sails the land, for Grom thwarts its progress whenever he can. Still, if the ship is of use to you, you shall have it.
I thank you, King Strasha. Where shall I find it?
It will come. And now I grow weary, for the further from my own realm I venture, the harder it is to sustain my mortal form. Farewell, Elric, and be cautious. You have a greater power than you know, and many would make use of it to their own ends.
Shall I wait here for the ship which sails over land and sea?
No.
The Sea King's voice was fading as his form faded. Gray mist drifted back where the silhouette and the green lights had been. The sea, again, was still.
Wait. Wait in your tower. It will come.
A few wavelets lapped the shore, and then it was as if the King of the Water Elementals had never been there at all. Divim Tavar rubbed his eyes. Slowly at first he began to move where Elric still sat. Gently he bent down and offered the albino his hand. Elric looked up in some surprise. Ah, Divim Tavar, how much time has passed?
Some hours, Elric. It will soon be night. What little light there is begins to wane. We had best ride back for Imrir.
Stiffly, Elric rose to his feet with Divim Tavar's assistance.
Aye. The Sea King said...
I heard the Sea King, Elric. I heard his advice and I heard his warning. You must remember to heed both. I like too little the sound of this magic boat. Like most things of sorcerous origin, the ship appears to have vices as well as virtues. Like a double-bladed knife,
which you raise to stab your enemy and which, instead, stabs you. That must be expected where sorcery is concerned. It was you who urged me on, my friend.
Aye,
said Divam Tavar, almost to himself, as he led the way up the cliff path towards the horses.
I have not forgotten that, my lord king.
Elric smiled and touched Divam Tavar's arm.
Worry not. The summoning is over, and now we have the vessel we need to take us swiftly to Prince Yirkun and the lands of Oin and you. Let us hope so.
Divam Tavar was privately skeptical about the benefits they would gain from the ship which sails over land and sea. They reached the horses and he began to wipe the water off the flanks of his own roan.
I regret that we have once again allowed the dragons to expend their energy on a useless endeavor. With the squadron of my beast we could do much against Prince Yirkun. And it would be fine and wild, my friend, to ride the skies again side by side, as we used to.
When all this is done, and Princess Cymeral brought home, we shall do that, said Elric, hauling himself wearily into the saddle of his white stallion.
You shall blow the dragon horn, and our dragon brothers will hear it, and you and I shall sing the song of the dragon masters. And our goads shall flash as we straddle Flame Fang and his mate Sweep Claw. Ah, that will be like the days of old Melnibone, when we no longer equate freedom with power, but let the young kingdoms go their own way, and be certain that they let us go ours.
Divam Tavar pulled on his horse's reins. His brow was clouded.
Let us pray that day will come, my lord. But I cannot help this nagging thought which tells me that Ymir's days are numbered, and that my own life nears its close.
Nonsense, Divam Tavar. You will survive me. There's little doubt of that, though you be my elder. Divam Tavar said as they galloped back through the closing day.
I have two sons. Did you know that, Elric?
You have never mentioned them.
They are by my old mistresses.
I am happy for you.
They are fine Melnibonians.
Why do you mention this, Divam Tavar? Elric tried to read his friend's expression.
It is that I love them, and would have them enjoy the pleasures of the Dragon Isle.
And why should they not?
I do not know. I could suggest that it is your responsibility, the fate of my sons, Elric.
Mine?
It seems to me, from what I gathered from the Water Elemental's words, that your decisions could decide the fate of the Dragon Isle. I ask you to remember my sons, Elric.
I shall, Divam Tavar. I am certain they shall grow into superb dragon masters, and that one of them shall succeed you as Lord of the Dragon Caves.
I think you miss my meaning, my Lord Emperor.
And Elric looked solemnly at his friend and shook his head.
I do not miss your meaning, old friend, but I think you judge me harshly if you fear I'll do aught to threaten Melnibone and all she is.
Forgive me, then. Divam Tavar lowered his head, but the expression in his eyes did not change. In Ymir, they changed their clothes and drank hot wine and had spiced food brought. Elric, for all his weariness, was in better spirits than he had been for many a month, and yet there was still a tinge of something behind his surface mood which suggested he encouraged himself to speak gaily and put vitality into his movements. Admittedly, thought Divam Tavar, the prospects had improved, and soon they would be confronting Prince Yirkun. But the dangers ahead of them were unknown, the pitfalls probably considerable. Still, he did not, out of sympathy for his friend, want to dispel Elric's mood. He was glad, in fact, that Elric seemed in a more positive frame of mind. There was talk of the equipment they would need in their expedition to the mysterious lands of Yu and Oin. Speculation concerning the capacity of the ship which sails over land and sea, how many men it would take, what provisions they should put aboard, and so on. When Elric went to his bed, he did not walk with the dragging tiredness which had previously accompanied his step. And again, bidding him good night, Dyvim Tavar was struck by the same emotion which had filled him on the beach, watching Elric begin his rune. Perhaps it was not by chance that he had used the example of his sons when speaking to Elric earlier that day, for he had a feeling that was almost protective, as if Elric were a boy looking forward to some treat which might not bring him the joy he expected. Dyvim Tavar dismissed the thoughts as best he could and went to his own bed. Elric might blame himself for all that had occurred in the question of Irkun and Simril, but Dyvim Tavar wondered if he too were not to blame in some part. Perhaps he should have offered his advice more cogently, more vehemently even, earlier, and made a stronger attempt to influence the young emperor. And then, in the Melnibonean manner, he dismissed such doubts and questions as pointless. There was only one rule: seek pleasure however you would. But had that always been the Melnibonean way? Dyvim Tavar wondered suddenly if Elric might not have regressive rather than deficient blood. Could Elric be a reincarnation of one of their most distant ancestors? Had it always been in the Melnibonean character to think only of oneself and one's own gratification? And again Dyvim Tavar dismissed the questions. What use was there in questions? After all, the world was the world. A man was a man. Before he sought his own bed, he went to visit both his old mistresses, waking them up and insisting that he see his sons, Dyvim Slorm and Dyvim Mav. And when his sons, sleepy-eyed, bewildered, had been brought to him, he stared at them for a long while before sending them back. He had said nothing to either, but he brought his brows together frequently and rubbed at his face and shaken his head, and when they were gone, he said to Niopol and Saramel, his mistresses, who were as bewildered as their offspring, "Let them be taken to the dragon caves tomorrow and begin their learning." "So soon, Dyvim Tavar?" said Niopol. "Aye, there's little time left, I fear." He would not amplify on this remark because he could not. It was merely a feeling he had, but it was a feeling that was growing almost to the point where it was becoming an obsession with him. In the morning, Dyvim Tavar returned to Elric's tower and found the Emperor pacing the gallery above the city, asking eagerly for any news of a ship sighted off the coast of the island. But no such ship had been seen. Servants answered earnestly that if their emperor could describe the ship, it would be easier for them to know for what to look. But he could not describe the ship, and could only hint that it might not be seen on water at all, but might appear on land. He was all dressed up in his black war gear, and it was plain to Dyvim Tavar that Elric was indulging in even larger quantities of the potions which replenished his blood. The crimson eyes gleamed with a hot vitality, the speech was rapid, and the bone-white hands moved with unnatural speed when Elric made even the lightest gesture.
"Are you well this morning, my lord?"
"In excellent spirits, thank you, Dyvim Tavar. Though I'd feel even better if the ship which sails over land and sea were here now." He went to the balustrade and leaned upon it, peering over the towers and beyond the city walls, looking first to the sea and then to the land.
"Where can it be? I wish that King Strasha had been able to be more specific." "I'll agree with that."
Dyvim Tavar, who had not breakfasted, helped himself from the variety of succulent foods laid upon the table. It was evident that Elric had eaten nothing. Dyvim Tavar began to wonder if the volume of potions had not affected his old friend's brain. Perhaps madness, brought about by his involvement with complicated sorcery, his anxiety for Simril, and his hatred of Irkun, had begun to overwhelm Elric.
"Would it not be better to rest and to wait until the ship is sighted?"
Aye, there's reason in that. But I cannot. I have an urge to be off, Divam Tavar, to come face to face with Yarkun, to have my revenge on him, and to be united with Simril again.
I understand that, yet still...
You fret like tanglebones over my well-being. I do not need two nursemaids, Lord of the Dragon Caves.
With an effort, Divam Tavar smiled.
You are right. Well, I pray that this magic vessel... What is that?
He pointed out across the land.
A movement in yonder forest as if the wind passes through it, but there is no sign of wind elsewhere.
Elric followed his gaze.
You are right. I wonder.
And then they saw something emerge from the forest, and the land itself seemed to ripple. It was something which glinted white and blue and black. It came closer.
A sail. It is your ship, I think, my lord.
Aye, my ship.
Make yourself ready, Divam Tavar. By midday, we shall be gone from Imrir.
The ship was tall and slender, and she was delicate. Her rails, masts, and bulwarks were exquisitely carved and obviously not the work of a mortal craftsman. Though built of wood, the wood was not painted but naturally shone blue and black and green and a kind of deep smoky red. And her rigging was the color of seaweed, and there were veins in the planks of her polished deck like the roots of trees. And the sails on her three tapering masts were as fat and white and light as clouds on a fine summer day. The ship was everything that was lovely in nature. Few could look upon her and not feel delighted, as they might be delighted upon sighting a perfect view. In a word, the ship radiated harmony, and Elric could think of no finer vessel in which to sail against Prince Yarkun and the dangers of the lands of Oin and Yu. The ship sailed gently in the ground, as if upon the surface of a river, and the earth beneath the keel rippled, as if turned momentarily to water. Wherever the keel of the ship touched, and a few feet around it, this effect became evident, though after the ship had passed, the ground would return to its usual stable state. This was why the trees of the forest had swayed as the ship passed through them, parting before the keel as the ship sailed towards Imrir. The ship which sails over land and sea was not particularly large. Certainly she was considerably smaller than a Melnibonean battle barge, and only a little bigger than a southern galley. But the grace of her, the curve of her line, the pride of her bearing, in these she had no rival at all. Already her gangplanks had been lowered down to the ground, and she was being made ready for her journey. Elric, hands on his slim hips, stood looking up at King Strasha's gift. From the gates of the city wall, slaves were bearing provisions and arms and carrying them up the gangways. Meanwhile, Divam Tavar was assembling the Imririan warriors and assigning them their ranks and duties while on the expedition. There were not many warriors. Only half the available strength could come with the ship, for the other half must remain behind, under the command of Admiral Makum Kolin, and protect the city. It was unlikely there would be any large attack on Melnibonay after the punishment meted out to the barbarian fleet, but it was wise to take precautions, particularly since Prince Yarkun had vowed to conquer Imrir. Also, for some strange reason that none of the onlookers could divine, Divam Tavar had called for volunteers, veterans who shared a common disability, and made up a special detachment of these men who, so the onlookers thought, could be of no use at all to the expedition. Still, neither were they of use when it came to defending the city, so they might as well go. These veterans were led aboard first. Last to climb the gangway was Elric himself. He walked slowly, heavily, a proud figure in his black armor, until he reached the deck. Then he turned, saluted his city, and ordered the gangplank raised. Divam Tavar was waiting for him on the poop deck. The Lord of the Dragon Caves had stripped off one of his gauntlets and was running his naked hand over the oddly colored wood of the rail.
This is not a ship made for war, Elric. I should not like to see it harmed.
How can it be harmed? Elric asked lightly as Imririans began to climb the rigging and adjust the sails.
Would Strasha let it be destroyed? Would Grom?
Fear not for the ship which sails over land and sea, Divan Tavar. Fear only for our own safety and the success of our expedition.
Now, let us consult the charts. Remembering Strasha's warning concerning his brother Grom, I suggest we travel by sea for as far as possible, calling in here.
He pointed to a seaport on the western coast of Loramir.
To get our bearings and learn what we can of the lands of Oin and Yu, and how those lands are defended. Few travelers have ever ventured beyond Loramir. It is said that the edge of the world lies not far from that country's most southerly borders.
Divan Tavar frowned.
Could not this whole mission be a trap, I wonder? Arioch's trap. What if he is in league with Prince Irkun, and we have been completely deceived into embarking upon an expedition which will destroy us?
I have considered that, but there is no other choice. We must trust Arioch.
I suppose we must. Another matter now occurs to me. How does the ship move? I saw no anchors we could raise, and there are no tides that I know of that sweep across the land. The wind fills the sails, see?
It was true. The sails were billowing, and the masts creaked slightly as they took the strain. Elric shrugged and spread his hands.
I suppose we must tell the ship.
Ship, we are ready to sail. Elric took some pleasure in Divan Tavar's expression of astonishment as, with a lurch, the ship began to move. It sailed smoothly as over a calm sea, and Divan Tavar instinctively clutched the rail, shouting,
"But we are heading directly for the city wall!"
Elric crossed quickly to the center of the poop where a large lever lay, horizontally attached to a ratchet, which in turn was attached to a spindle. This was almost certainly the steering gear. Elric grasped the lever as one might grasp an oar and pushed it round a notch or two. Immediately the ship responded and turned towards another part of the wall. Elric hauled back on the lever and the ship leaned, protesting a little as she yawed around and began to head out across the island. Elric laughed in delight.
You see, Divan Tavar, it is easy. A slight effort of logic was all it took. Nonetheless, I'd rather we rode dragons. At least they are beasts and may be understood, but this sorcery, it troubles me. Those are not fitting words for a noble of Melniboné. Perhaps not. Perhaps that explains why I stand beside you now, my lord.